Hey, everybody, I'm Andy Weinberg, and welcome to episode 67 of the David Wasikinen In the Pocket podcast. We're here in the studio in Wildfire Radio Studios in Woodbury, New Jersey. We're also, I believe, live on PhillyRockRadio.com. And some of you might be watching us right now via Zoom on Facebook or YouTube or wherever else you watch your Zoom interviews these days. So welcome. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Andy. How you doing, bud? Good to see you.
Great to see you across the table. So socially
through
distanced
the microphone
here.
Stands.
Yeah, right. And we're joined, and we're going to get to him in just a few minutes. If you're watching on video right now, you can see him. We're so fortunate this week to have as a guest the Grammy-winning producer, engineer, musician, songwriter, and a whole bunch of other titles I'm probably forgetting.
The man could do anything.
His name is William Whitman. As Dave says, he's done it all. He's got a long history with the Hooters.
Yeah.
Goes way back with Dave and a ton of other huge musical acts, and we're going to get into all of it with the great and extremely talented William Whitman in just a few minutes.
Can't wait.
Before we get started with that, I do want to mention our sponsors. We're thrilled to have back with us this week our great friend of the show, Trudy Handelman, and GotPeace.com. Her company makes all kinds of really cool merchandise that promotes peace. They got caps, they got shirts, they got little stuffed cows, bunch of great stuff, promotes messages of peace and unity. And it's not politically affiliated.
Oh, we could need it now.
So it's just about promoting peace, and you know, which is always a great cause. So check it out, gotpeace.com. Thank you so much, Trudy, for your continued support. Great,
always.
Great to have you back. Again, we're also sponsored by Croker Percussion, great friend of the show, Eric Metz. And Croker has just received a U.S. patent for their bended strings snare system.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Invented by Ben Metz, who's owner Eric Metz's son. At the age of just 16, Croker Cajones, is that how you pronounce it, right, Dave? Cajones?
Yeah, very good.
Croker Cajones and brush boxes use bended strings snare technology to provide a snare sound effect through this unique installation of guitar strings. In a cajon, this offers a clean, crisp snare sound in the high tones while virtually eliminating them from the bass tones. In a brush box, this adds a quick, snappy snare sound when the playing surface is struck. Learn more at www.crokerpercussion.com. That's crokerpercussion.com. Or you can give Eric a call at 215-669-8588. I know Dave swears by Croker Percussion.
Yeah, I love it.
It's great. He plays it on the show sometimes. Cool stuff, so check it out.
Yeah.
And I know also, Dave wants to mention our friends at the School of Rock Berwyn.
Great program.
Dave teaches there. Great turning young musicians into future rock stars.
I was there yesterday. I gave a lesson there yesterday, a couple lessons, and they're doing that whole social distancing thing. There was me and another student through a little plastic. I mean, it's kind of weird, you know, a little plastic glass and but we're getting it done, and they have a stage, and I don't know if you could teach. Well, I don't think you could teach someone to be a rock star, but it's a great way to learn. You get up there and fun. It's a great
place
to hang out and play your instruments. It's a fantastic program.
They all got all the rock stars started somewhere, Dave.
Indeed, I'll tell you what. When I'm there, I'm thinking, man, if I had this place when I was a kid, you know, it would have been unbelievable. Yeah. A stage with Marshall amps and some AC-30s. Forget about it. It's really cool.
Yeah, so check it out at schoolofrock.com and click on the Berwyn entry. That's where Dave teaches. Maybe if you're a young drummer, you'll have Dave as a teacher at some point.
I'll abuse you.
All right, well, let's get to it. We have on the line, as we were saying earlier, the great William Whitman, producer, engineer, mixer, musician himself. He's just done it all, and we've done it with tons of people. And let's kick right off with the history between the two of you, William and Dave, because Dave credits you for teaching him how to tune drums.
Bill probably doesn't remember it. The very first session I did with Bill was on, we did it at K-Jam for Fighting on the Same Side. We were doing Fighting on the Same Side, and we were doing Wireless. And at the time, I think I brought my drums in there, and we didn't spend a lot of time on them, but Bill was pretty adamant about how he wanted a snare drum sound, and I've never seen anything like it. Now, that was the first experience, but where I really learned a lot, and I don't know if he realized when you just finished working, we were doing Nervous Night, and And you just work with a band called The Kind. I don't know if you remember. I think that's what the band was. But Russ Kunkel, I think, did the session. And I think I brought, yeah. I was using these black ebony heads. And you, I think Kunkel might have had a set of those, too. And we were, Bill taught me how to tune the toms. Like, I was like, well, the way he taught me, he just did it. Bill said, get out of here. Get out of the way. Let me do this. So I just watched him. And I knew from the first time I met Bill, I said, I got to pay attention to what this guy does, because not to give you a big head, but Bill was just the most unique cat, quiet, as humble as can be, and I'll tell you, you'll find out through the podcast, the guy can do anything, and not only musically but athletically too. It's pretty unbelievable. So, long way to get back to the tuning, but when we were doing the drum, I was watching him. Just he was going about it, you know, right by the lug, and he was listening to the timbre of the sound of the drum, just hitting it, and then he'll go across. And it was before DW were writing 1-2, like doing it on, you know, writing it for drummers to see. You go here, go across, but Bill was doing this, and he tuned the drums, and I remember, and the snare drum, and like how he tuned that snare drum. I never experienced anything like that before. So from that time on, every time I did any kind of session, I was trying to do the same thing, and it was an amazing learning experience that I never had one like that. It was great. Thank you, Bill. It's your fault. It was great.
Well, you know, I think a lot of any engineer or producer who's smart figures out pretty quickly that the way to get something recorded well is for the actual source to sound good. So,
yeah,
you know, a lot of
true.
Us were sort of forced to learn how to do things like tune drums and adjust guitar amps. So even if it wasn't your instrument, you had to learn how to make it sound good, because if it doesn't sound good out there, it's not going to sound good to the microphone.
Yeah, indeed. Well, it was a great learning experience for me. But like on every instrument,
I don't think get out of the way, by the way.
What's that?
You said, get out of my way.
Well, what was great too, but Bill was like that with every instrument and the miking, you know. It was just a great experience. We got really, really lucky with Bill as a band. You know, he was him and Bill, Rick Chertoff, who was producing our record. They worked together at the time. We were very fortunate to have Bill be our because he taught us all at the same time where he recorded. You know, it's like, I think producing sometimes you're like a pickpocket. That's why I think a lot of artists sometimes think that they produce their own records, or they after a record they go, well, I can do that. Engineers, they're just, and great producers are like magicians.
Well, let me ask that, because to the layman, to the person listens to a song, hey, I love this song or I love this album, the average music listener isn't paying attention to the production necessarily. They're listening to the lyrics, they're listening to the music, but they don't know, and they don't think about everything that goes into it behind the scenes to create a great record. And William has worked on so many incredible records, multi-platinum records. He's been with Cyndi Lauper forever. He plays in her band. He's Joan Osborne, The Outfield, The Hooters, all these great, huge records. But William, to the average person who doesn't think, okay, what goes into producing or engineering a song, kind of, I don't know, put it in layman's terms, it's kind of a nebulous term, producer, because there's so much you're involved in. How do you describe it to the person that doesn't think about, well, music production? How important is that? I mean,
right. Important.
Yeah, obviously, but kind of sell it.
I think one thing, the definition these days tends to be slightly different than it was, but my view of a record producer is analogous to a film director, that you're essentially the director of recording, and that can still run a range from the director who's got a very specific story, he's going to have it told exactly his own way, and then there are other directors who are going to give the brief to the actors and just let's see what the actors do and I'll put it together in the editing. And, you know, there are different ways to look at it, but it comes down to essentially the same thing. You're filling in the gaps to tell the story and communicate what the record needs to communicate. And sometimes that requires a heavy hand, and sometimes that requires sitting back and going, nope, I think take 3 is the one and not take 4. And it can, again, run a range, but I think somebody has to be the hand on the big picture of the record. Is the record making you laugh, making you cry, making you dance, whatever it's supposed to do? Somebody's got to have that big picture, and it's very difficult from inside the operation. If you're in the band, if you're singing, and even if you're, I would argue, even as the engineer, it's difficult to have that big picture all the time. Somebody needs to be able to sit back in that chair and see the forest for the trees, and that's pretty much what a record producer is supposed to do anyway.
Yeah. I imagine as every music producer has had some legendary clashes with the artists they've been working with through the years. I'm sure you've had, you know, where you're you know, banging heads with the musicians who they see it this way, you see it this way. You don't have to name names, but I mean, have you had stories like that through the years where you just feel really strongly about how something should be done and the musician's saying, well, no, I want to do it this way?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think it's down to personalities. I'm not a super confrontational kind of guy, you know, so I will try to fight for what I want, but I mean, I say to artists all the time, I'm here because you want to know what I think about this. And it's my job to tell you that I think you're wrong here. And it's still your record. Your name's going on it. Mine's in tiny letters. Yours is in big letters. It's still going to matter what you... The artist is always essentially going to have veto power. But if you're not taking at least into consideration the advice of the guy that you're hiring to do this, then that's silly.
Right.
You know, so I think most of the time, it's not so, I mean, it's butting heads in the sense that not everybody's going to have the same idea at any given moment. But I think ultimately you tend to come to a consensus. It's never going to be, at least in my experience, it's not going to be a heavy-handed, no, it's going to be my way from either side. Those relationships are just not good producer-artist relationships. I don't think they last if it's really going to be that serial.
Right.
Bill, I mean, you've done so much work. I mean, when Andy was doing your introduction, I was thinking, it hit me. I remember, I think you even worked on the Breakwater record.
Whoever that guy is really interesting. I don't know.
Didn't you do the Breakwater record? Did you work on that record with Rick? I mean, that's going way back. And of course the A's, but I remember the Breakwater that whole time. And of course the, I think you did some of the Baby Grand record as well, some of that stuff.
I made, that was the first full-on thing I did with Rick was the second Baby Grand album, the whole second album. Yeah.
How did you, let's go back, because obviously your history, we're going back into the early 70s there. How did you get involved in that?
That's a great question, because that was something I used to say, how the fuck does this guy know all this stuff? I used to think that, Bill. I was like, because I was amazed, because it's back in the day. We're talking analog.
Well, you had to be practical. If we're going back to Baby Grand, he had to be about 6 years old producing that, working on this record. I mean, he's a young guy. Look at him. So
yeah, I mean, Bill has always had this attorney, you know, like he looks, you know.
You should see my liver. the story there was, it's kind of a weird story that I, at that time, was a staff engineer at a studio in Manhattan. And Arista Records, Clive Davis, made a deal with that studio where the studio was trying to get cash flow, basically. And so they made a deal with Clive. Clive said, how about if I give you, I don't know what the number was, $50,000 or $100,000 in advance, but then instead of paying $180 an hour, I want my artist to pay you'll bill us back $125 an hour out of that advance. So in exchange for a better rate, I'll give you a bunch of money up front.
Wow. Okay.
That was the deal.
Uh-huh.
And so the studio was happy to have a lump of money. Clive wanted a place with a lower studio rate, and so that was the deal. And at that time, Rick Chertoff was an Arista staff producer. And so now, naturally, Clive has made a deal that he thinks is genius at some studio that Rick's never heard of. And so he said, I want you to go record at this place, Sound Mixers, because we have a deal there. And so Rick, I think, kind of reluctantly said to them, who do you have who's kind of more album rock oriented? And I had already a history of...
Yeah. Do you remember where Rick wanted to go? Do you remember the place that...
he had been working at... he had been working at Sigma prior to that, and I think he had some Sigma New York.
Uh-huh.
And he had some issues, I think, about the nature of the kind of sound that was coming out of there, that it was a kind of a deader, more R&B focused. I mean, brilliant for what it is, but not wasn't for a rock record and the kind of records he was listening to and wanted to make, I think, in some cases. So it was a happy coincidence, but mostly I think Clive was pressuring him to go check out another studio.
Mm.
And I know I played him I had done, and it was not necessarily exactly what he was looking for, but it seemed like I was the guy there that was most simpatico. We listened to the same records. We came from the same place, uh-huh. about the same age.
Right.
I know I remember saying, while he was still on the fence, I think, a bit, I said, well, why don't you bring Baby Grand in over a weekend? We'll give you a free weekend. We'll just come in and record a day or 2 days.
Right.
And that's what we did. The band came in and we set up and we recorded one song.
Was that with Alan Schwartzberg playing drums? Was that the thing? Because I think
No, this is the second album. David Prater is in the band.
Oh, okay, cool.
So they came in. That's when I met Rob and Eric for the first time, and it was Carmen Rojas and David Prater. And anyway, and David Kagan singing. And so we recorded one song, and I guess they liked it enough that we ended up working together pretty much ever since. I mean, we did a few things. Mm. I did a lot of other work for Aris in that period because of that deal, too. But but Rick ended up doing Baby Grand and also 1.5 Breakwater Records there as well. So
wow. I mean, that's the days, Andy. Another thing that, like, I would marvel at, and there's probably some engineers, friends of Bill, that will see this. I remember watching him edit tape. Now, I've only seen that, like, a few times up to the time, but, you know, here you go. You know, you have a tape machine. It's a lot different than what you see today. A guy has this, you know, massive machine with two-inch reels of tape, and here's this guy in the middle hearing the sound. And then finding that spot. And Bill, you know, it's like cutting this tape, like, you know, stuff you played and editing things. I mean, that was remarkable stuff to me to see that go down. And then you know, this look, you know, when you hear it back and, you know, can you hear the edit? And usually, most times, you know, it was just seamless. I mean, with Bill, it was always seamless.
It's funny. My very first. I had done a lot of sort of freelance, not really getting paid, sort of getting paid. When I first started engineering, I mean, way before that.
Yeah.
Because I backdoored out of being in a rock band to sort of worming my way into engineering places and making producing records. But the first real sort of here's your full-time paid job in the business was I got a job editing classical music. That they would hand you the score and a bunch of notes and the quarter-inch stereo masters of the whole orchestra or the chamber orchestra, whatever it was, and they'd say, the conductor's notes say, take bars 26 through 28 from take 3 and cut it into take 5.
Wow.
And so these were a one-off. If you screwed this up, that was it. You know, tens of thousands of dollars of orchestral recording was destroyed. Cutting tape is so no big deal to me. It's funny now, people are even more freaked out because nobody sees it anymore. So now if you cut a 2-inch piece of tape, people are just, like it's never been done.
Yeah.
Whereas, of course, back then, really common.
Yeah.
I'm curious how you got into this, though, from the very beginning. Even as you said you were a musician and then you kind of backdoored your way into doing the engineering and the producing. I mean, were you just fascinated from that aspect of it from the beginning, or was there somebody who you talked to who got you into it? How did you?
Sometimes I think because I never asked you the question, was this out of necessity? Because you were signed, you had a band. Were you on Apple? I heard this story that one time you had a band, you were on Apple Records, and so I'm thinking, well, Bill, well, I'll engineer it, and you learned, you know, you jumped right into the fire, boom.
Sort of like that. I was just the one, even before that, I was just the one who was interested. Sorry, making bell noises here. I was just the one who was interested. I was always like, oh, a recording studio, this is really cool. And I wanted to look in the control room. I wanted to know what was going on. I went, oh, how do you put the mic over there? A lot of people just were not. I mean, even now, although now that's less so because everybody now has a thing at home where they're recording themselves.
Everybody's a producer.
It's not something people were interested in, and I was just the one who was interested. So I would be paying attention. I would be asking questions, and then I would sort of say, can I come back and watch some other sessions? And and then because we had access to studios, I would find myself recording my own band and playing around with it and trying to figure it out.
Right.
And then eventually people said, oh, I like the demo you made for your band. Would you come and help us make ours? And I sort of wormed my way into being known for doing a certain level of engineering. And not too long after that, I got some serious phone calls where people said, can you come? Fred can't make it on Thursday. Can you come and record the guitars for us? And I worked with some relatively major
back in the day,
largely uncredited.
Who was the first guy, musician that you worked with and you kind of went, oh my God, like you had a thought, like I'm working with so-and-so and you heard him play records and he had a reputation. Can you think, would you remember who that would be?
I don't know. No, I don't really know.
Well,
it's funny. It's you know, you're going back a long time.
Yeah.
I did some work with Jethro Tull, with Not the Hoople, with, I made Cat Stevens. I mean,
I'm impressed. That's something.
Yeah, that's
impressive.
Well, obviously the first credited album that you worked on that was just huge, that blew up, that's still, you know, one of the best-selling albums of the 80s, if not ever, is Cyndi Lauper, and She's So Unusual.
Yeah.
And you've pretty much been with Cyndi ever since. Can you talk about the whole experience with, you know, working with Cyndi initially, first meeting her, working on that album? Did you know it was going to be huge? Give us a little of the backstory of that album and Cyndi in general.
And mind you, Bill, here's the thing, because, you know, musicians tend to be a little bit myopic. You know, like, I'm in my world. I had no idea, first of all, I didn't realize what an incredible musician he was. I didn't know. I mean, he was our engineer, and he always... I see Eric talking to him about, you know, a guitar sound, and it just seemed to know. And then mind-blowing event that he probably wasn't significant to him, but for me, and this is years later, he's playing with Too Much Joy, and he invites me to the Whiskey A Go-Go, and I see this guy jump over a bass amp. Like, I mean, literally jump over a bass amp with his bass, and he's playing. He's, like, ridiculously great. The band's rocking, and it was Bill. And I went, I didn't even knew this side of you. It was, like, unbelievable.
But that's a whole other story,
yeah,
Dave.
Exactly.
But let's get to it.
He doesn't talk about this stuff, so that's what's great.
Well, we're going to get him to talk about Cyndi a little bit now and that album. And we'll start with, like, the first time you met her and what your initial impressions were.
Well, before I met her, Lenny Pizzi, who had signed, he was the head of Epic A&R at the time, had signed her and had played before. Rick hadn't met her either. Lenny played us the videos that she had made of her band Blue Angel, which was her previous band. And so that was the first time I saw her or heard her was on a couple of Blue Angel videos that Rick showed me Lenny had given to him. And then he had her up to the office at Columbia, sister label. And so I met her there in the building. I'm pretty sure it was this first time that I met her that at the end of the meeting, which was kind of interesting anyway, because, you know, she's a pretty intense character in her way. You know, she sort of comes in with all guns blazing, like, I'm going to shoot you before you shoot me and make sure that you know who's in charge here. Anyway, we had an okay first, you know, everybody get to know each other a bit. And then as we're leaving the building, you had to sign in and out of the CBS building.
Right.
It was CBS Records, but also CBS Corporate.
Right.
As we were leaving, the security guard kind of motioned her over to the desk and turned the around and said, are you actually Ella Fitzgerald? Because that's how she had signed into that. for signing into the introduction.
That's great. So
to answer your other question, jump ahead a little bit, Absolutely, we thought great songs and cool record and fun to listen to, but did we think it was going to be huge? You always hope it's going to, a record's going to do well, but massive. Absolutely nobody knew this record was going to be big.
Yeah.
It was certainly not a safe record.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember very clearly, I told a story in writing somewhere just the other day, but I remember at the end, we had finished it, the Hooters guys were gone, and Rick and I and Cindy pretty much mixed the record on it, just the three of us in the room, sometimes Lenny. And the record was all done, and Rob and Eric came back into town, and we played the record back in the control room. And I remember Rob turning around, Hyman, turning around and saying, well, I really like it, but I don't know who the fuck is going to listen to this.
Is that what he said? Wow.
Yeah. I understood exactly. Everybody knew what he meant.
Wow.
It sounded nothing like what was on the radio.
Oh, wow.
There was nothing safe about it.
True.
I mean, it was unique in a quirky way. I mean, and it was a risk.
Right. Time After Time was already, when you heard that, Time was already done. Because wasn't Time one of the last songs recorded?
It was more about Just Want to Have Fun, I think. But in general, Time After Time, I started to say, it was about the only thing on that record that I felt, okay, this has to be a hit. It's just so special.
Wow.
But that doesn't mean you're right. You know, we've all been wrong times, too.
Right. Yeah,
but it resonated. I mean, obviously the videos helped. I mean, her personality, yep. The quirkiness. I mean, and great songs. I mean, you guys, there were great songwriters on that album, Rob and Eric and Robert Hazard and Jules Shear. I mean, it was great songs. And like you said, nobody was presenting songs in the way that she presented those songs. I mean, it was
the total package.
It was just it was as
the total package.
It was the girls was just the perfect thing for that woman to say at that time, and that I mean, it just everything came together in a lucky or fortuitous way.
Right.
But can't take out of the picture the fact people tend to reduce her a little bit to that, you know, to say quirky personality, great videos, you know, telling the story, but can't take out of the picture that she is just an amazing singer.
Amazing.
Oh, the voice is incredible. I mean, it's.
Yes.
Yeah, and smart. She's right. Just like ridiculous, and knows and assertive as well. Because you know, I'm always getting it from people like you know, people saying, "Well, you because of Rob and Eric, I always get you played on it." I work with her later on and on other things, and I was always struck by her authority. You know, when she came in, you know, she said to me, you know, matter of fact, I think she looked at Robert, don't listen to those two. Listen to me. She was not fucking around. She was serious. And I really, I remember thinking, wow. And that voice, that was one thing that struck me too, is that, I never heard an instrument like that. I mean, she's, in the male vocal world, I always thought of Steve Winwood as that incredible voice. And Cindy has that incredible instrument with her voice. It was just mind-blowing. You could pick it out anywhere, but the range she has is just ridiculous.
Plus, the album produced one of the few hits about masturbation. I mean, you had that.
Yeah.
I mean, was there any reservations
girls
about
all over,
no?
Yeah.
She bop was
right,
all
exactly.
About she bop, he bop, we all bop. Yeah.
Yeah.
Any reservations about releasing that song as a single or anything like that at the time?
I don't think so. I think everybody was relishing the idea more than having reservations.
Yeah.
I think everybody was going
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, I don't know. I wanted to ask about another record. Are we moving on from Cindy?
We can move. We can always go back.
It's one of my favorite records that you did, and I every time it comes on, I'll blast it because I love what you did with that Outfield record, that very first Outfield record. And I have to ask you. There's that. Was it the first single? What was the first single?
Well, Your Love was the big hit.
There's a breakdown section that had to be built because I know about Bill thinks sometimes and his drum. I'm forgetting the drummer's name. Pug, What was it? He had a
Plug.
Right, Plug had a nickname. We were on a tour, and I in this middle section of one of the songs, it was the huge single, and forgive me because I forget the name, but there was a part in it, and I'm thinking, this sounds like a Whitman idea. Plop, boom, boom, when he did this. I think it's Your Love.
It's in the last verse of Your Love when it comes back. It kind of quiets back down, and yeah. I wanted something for men. And Alan Plug is an incredible drummer. And
incredible.
We'll put some drum fills on.
Yeah. You did such an amazing job on that record, and the vocals, and you had, again, Tony, what a great instrument. That voice is phenomenal. And how you managed, how was your working relationship with John? Because John was a real colorful character. He tended to be a little bit strong-minded and, you know, emotional. How'd that go?
Yeah, mostly that record was a lot of fun. It took a very long time, and it was very painstaking. I was in my sort of, I don't know, I guess I felt the pressure of taking on that band and the pressure to make it everything that it could be. And so I was in my also fresh off a record with Mike Chapman before that. Mike and I had made the Scandal record together. And he was crazy meticulous and had kind of instilled in me at that point in my life that kind of focus on, if we're going to do eighth notes, I mean, Michael told me the story that with Blondie, he would say, okay, today we're going to do eighth note guitars. And he said, for the next 8 or 10 hours, we would stand there doing eighth note guitars.
Wow.
And if I had to stop every bar and drop in again and fix it, we were going to get... Remember, there's no cutting and pasting. This is analog tape. So if it took all day to get eighth notes, we got perfect eighth notes. And then he said, and tomorrow we double it. And it was all day.
Wow.
So the outfield was very much that. The thing that took... which is to say that I was very, very... particular, that if it wasn't right, we kept at it until it was right. And it took a very long time, especially the vocals took, because there's, you know, I was the other person I was, let's say, borrowing or making an homage to on that record took to a large degree, my friend Roy Thomas Baker, that those background vocals are very much in the Queen, Charles, Roy mode. In fact, a friend of mine was working down the hallway at Air when I was making that record, and he always said the outfield sounded like, he called them the police cars. So he said they sounded like
the police cars. That's good.
What is their name?
Yeah.
But anyway, the vocals took an extremely long time because they're very, very layered up. Many of those songs have 60 or 80 voices in layers. That was all the three of us. It was Tony and me and a friend of theirs who was, I called the ringer, who we
Frankie?
Had brought in because he had another beautiful, high, similar voice, a guy named Frankie Callahan.
Yes, love Frankie.
And so Frankie and Tony and I sang all those vocals, and it would be the three of us, and we'd sing each part four times, so now you have 12 voices, and then we'd sing the next part each four times, and so we'd build that up in layers, and then I'd bounce them down and do it again, and so it's a lot of painstaking singing, and to get it, again, there's no pitch correction. If it's not right, you had to stop and drop in or do it again until it was right. It took a very, very long time to get that stuff done, but on the whole, though, the atmosphere was pretty fun. Those are really funny guys, and we all shared similar humor references and the things we loved, and you know, we'd make the same jokes and have the same references and just had pretty much a good time, although a lot of work was getting done. It was not a tense record, except for one or two disagreements that I've, you know, and you inevitably have about something. From the very first meeting, when I basically got the gig, I had said, they were meeting a couple of different producers that I guess their A&R guy had suggested as possibles.
Yeah.
And in the very first meeting, I said to John Spinks, I know you guys are a trio, which they were.
Yeah.
I don't want to make like a cinema verite here. I'm going to capture the trio like the first Police record or something. I don't want to do that. I hear these songs as huge.
Yes.
I want to do a lot of guitars and a lot of vocals and big drums and everything stretched, you know, sort of Def Leppard.
Right.
The Police, or as it turns out, Cars were the Police. But the thing is, and I saw John's eyes kind of light up, like, yes, my band can be bigger than life and not just the picture of, like, our demos, like the three of us. And, and so we were very much on the same wavelength. And I think it's also in the nature somewhat, and this is a good thing, it's in the nature of English-British bands to sort of give it up to the producer a little bit more, to understand, like, hey, this guy's the producer. There was a lot of times when I would turn to them. I remember Tony in particular, I would say, well, you like that harmony part or not? And he would say, well, you're the governor.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, it's up to you. You tell us if it's good.
Yeah.
So, you know, that puts a lot of pressure on the producer, but at the same time, it you know, there's not a lot of arguing back and forth. The only major argument I remember on that record was actually in the other direction. There was one song that I thought for relief I would keep really sort of simple and more straight ahead and not put all the big block harmonies on. And John was like, oh, no, you can't. Like, he felt like I was giving short shrift to that song. And I thought it was the relief on the album. He was like, no way, it's getting the big back on vocals just like everything.
Wow. Did the other guitar player, was it John on the whole album?
No, it was just the trio. There was just the three of them, and Frankie was the ringer.
Yeah.
And then we brought in a friend of theirs, Reg, who you probably know.
Oh, yeah, I know Reg.
Well.
Yeah. Rest in peace, yeah.
Came in and played keyboards
on
a couple of things, not on everything. I think maybe three, four songs had keyboards, mostly hidden. But, yeah, there's a little bit of keyboard in there. And then that was it. And then they had to put together a band for live.
Right.
I actually thought they should go out as a trio and augment however they had to.
Right.
But the manager did not think so.
They had a great look on stage because of two trees.
They added another guitar player, and Reg went as a keyboard player.
Yeah.
And I think Frankie, on the first tour, but certainly Frankie sang with him live as well.
Yeah.
So it's crazy, though. I mean, so we're talking 1985 now, and in the last 2 years, you've now worked on three of the albums that basically define the 80s. Nervous Night, She's So Unusual, and Play Deep from the Outfield. And
The Warrior.
The Warrior from Scandal, four. So at that, so you're still relatively. Well, I'm not young at this point, but young enough, and you've worked on these four huge '80s albums.
Right.
Did you? And you know, it's '80s. It's time of indulgence. It's a time. I mean, did you kind of bask in the glory of what you had accomplished over this relatively short period of time?
I wasn't unhappy, and you know, the phone's ringing. It keeps you busy to have records in the charts. But it's funny. I didn't. You know, I think it's in the nature of people who have ambition to get ahead in the music business. You have to be pretty ambitious, and you have to be pretty aggressive, have to be pushing. I remember, you know, Dave at the very beginning brought up The Kind, which is the whole sad story there. But anyway, I was making that record with Mike Chapman in L.A. I remember we were walking around one night. We went to dinner, and we were walking around Santa Monica. And I was saying, you know, I'm not getting to produce as much as I want, and I'd really like to. And I was just moaning sort of. And he said sort of what you're saying. He said, you know, you've got three records in the top 10 right now. Shut the fuck up.
Shut the fuck up.
Like,
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it was remarkable. And it just seemed like everything you touched was just on fire, you know. So it was a great time.
You know, some people say too. They look back and say, "Well, '80s, the music was of this. You know, that sound was of that time, and it doesn't hold up." I don't know. To me, maybe it's because I grew up in that era. I still love music of that era. I still think it's. I don't know. I don't. Yes, it sounds dated in places, but I still enjoy it. I mean, I don't know. When you look back at that music, William, what are your thoughts? I mean, do you feel like it holds up?
I mean, I think there are crappy generic 80s records where they put gated AMS verb on everything. I mean, I didn't do that anyway. So, I mean, I'm sure my records sound of their time, just like if you put on a 60s record, it sounds like a 60s record.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a bad thing.
Right.
I mean, I hope I didn't make records that you can't play now without cringing, you know, but there are some of those, but there are some of those from the 60s too.
Sure.
You know, there's some of those from every era. And in a weird way, there's an awful lot of, the 80s are kind of cool in a way, especially in alterna and indie
Sure.
I mean, every once in a while, you know, John in Yellow, who's a great king of indie rock.
Yeah, he's great.
Now, well, yeah, told me a couple of times, what did you do on the snare on the outfield? And said, because some indie band he's worked with really wants to sound 80s. Somebody who worked on it told me that there's a Foo Fighters record where they sampled the snare from the beginning of an outfield track, from the beginning of All the Love. There's a clear snare at the beginning.
Yeah.
And they said and used it. It's like, in a weird way, the 80s, people like to dismiss it as like, hair band 80s. Mm. But those sounds are funny
fantastic.
Way
right. Yeah.
I mean, no, not that they're okay, but they're actually trendy as long as you don't put it together in exactly the same way.
Was that a Black Beauty snare drum that you used on that? Because I remember you liked those snare drums. Ludwig Superphonic, I remember you tuning it for me. And that's where, again, I was watching and you got that snare drum, the crack that people would come up to me in interviews and just talk about the snare drum. And I said, you should call Bill Whitman. It was Bill, you know?
Well, thank you. But, I mean, the other thing is that room.
Record Plant.
You're talking about Studios now, not the outfield, but the room where we did that, Record Plant New York Studio B, was just an amazing drum room.
Yeah.
It was medium-sized room by Studios, 25 by 35. It was not huge, and fairly low. It was about 11 feet. But it was, every single surface was hard. It was just crazy live for the size that it was.
Yeah.
So that if you walked into this medium-sized room, your footsteps went...
Wow, like,
The drums just sounded enormous in there because it was so... It was actually kind of uncontrollably live, but that's what I loved about it.
Oh, yeah, it was fantastic. You've also, you know, not only that, but moving a little bit ahead about something, but I remember, which really blew me away, that you were working with Paul Rodgers... on a blues record, which I thought that was great because that shows your whole, you know.
It's interesting, Matt. On a covers record of kind of Memphis, Stax, that kind of stuff.
Stax stuff.
Where the things that Paul said, you know, when he first started singing, these are the things he loved. So I did two records now with those guys, basically the guys from the high rhythm section. And with a little mix of the Stax band mixed in. So Steve Potts and Michael Toles and the Hodges brothers and Hubby Turner. And those guys, so we made a blues record in Memphis with Cindy covering blues hits.
Yes.
With some of those guys and also Skip Pitts, who was the Shaft guitar player.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing. Section there, and then did a similar thing at what was Willie Mitchell's Studio Royal with those guys and Paul singing live, doing Stax hits.
Wow.
It was kind of interesting that the similarity there was in both cases, almost nobody in those bands had any idea who either Paul Rodgers or Cyndi Lauper was.
Oh, get out. Get out.
And in both cases,
how's
the reaction was very similar. That you know, there, yeah, boring. Oh, some English guy's coming in, he's going to sing. And then Paul walks in, and he steps on the microphone, he starts singing, and they all go,
wow.
You know, there's that moment where they go, oh, this guy's the real deal. And the same thing with Cindy. They went, oh, she can actually sing.
Right.
It's funny to watch somebody be taken by surprise that it's just the sheer talent. It's not the name recognition, because I had no idea who either people were.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Hey, I know, Dave, your good friend Jeffrey Gaines commented on your Facebook thread when you announced that you were going to have William on. Jeffrey talked about you working with him on his cover of Magnet and Steel from Walter Egan. I don't know if there's a story there or not, but I know Jeffrey was very complimentary of the work you did on that song.
Oh, that's really nice. I loved that record. It was the only thing we did together at that point. Just a single that the label had called me, the A&R person Sue Drew called me up and said, would you want to do this? It's for a film, or we want to do a version of Magnet and Steel.
Right, so.
My major contribution there was to take it out of threes and put it into fours. I mean, that I wanted to change the time, you know, because, but other than that, that once I had that idea, the rest of it sort of fell together, and you know, Jeff had a very clear idea what the guitar vibe should be and sang it. Oh, again, that's another case of A.
We lost you there for a second. We're losing William for a second. But that reason made me think of it, as you mentioned, Paul Rodgers and Cyndi Lauper as being just two people with just naturally great voices, and Jeffrey Gaines obviously fits into that mold as well. But
In fact, I'm pretty sure that we did the reference vocal and then came back the next day to try to sing it again and went, no, we're keeping the reference vocal. Pretty much the first time Jeffrey sang it, it was just so great that I'm pretty sure that's what's on the record.
Yeah, it's cool. And then I don't know if you've actually met him, but I know you did some work. You did some overdubs and mixing on the Bob Dylan song, Series of Dreams, which is a great song that should have been on Oh Mercy. Did you ever meet Bob when you were working on that or not?
I met Bob way after that, but okay. No, not when we were doing that. That was pretty much just remote control that we would sort of fixed it up a bit and mixed it and sent it off, and we would get word back, oh, Bob doesn't like this, does like that, and then was, you know, it happened pretty quickly, and he was ultimately happy with it. I've now heard there are a couple of different versions of that floating around. Ours was on the bootleg box set,
right, the original
Columbia.
Yeah, bootleg volumes 1-3, right?
Yeah, exactly. I still think, well, I would think that, but I still think that's the best version of it.
Right.
I sort of see why it felt a little unfinished that Daniel Lanois left it off, or somebody decided.
Well, I think Lanois wanted it on, and I think Bob ultimately said no. But that's what I read anyway. But
that makes sense. It did seem a little unfinished or untogether. I mean, we felt like it didn't have a unifying element. It was really interesting for me to sort of see how Lanois had put it together, or how he did put it together. It's that most records are based around some single unifying element that, let's say, the guitar play, you know, it could have been early on, it would have been Bob playing his acoustic guitar and singing, and everything else is playing to that. There was nothing like that on Series of Dreams. There was no single, the piano or the organ or the guitar. There was no, every element seemed like a little disparate overdub, even though it was happening at once. It sounded like there was nothing holding it all together. And I think we ended up adding, I know we added an organ, but I think we added Rick DeFonso playing acoustic guitar to be that, to be like, okay, if Bob had been the one thing driving the whole song, being the glue, what would it be? And I think that's what made that version feel like it had some sort of coherence and apparent. Yeah. Bob was happy, so I guess we did it.
What are you doing? I'm sure you're mixing and doing a ton of stuff. You've been busy through this whole COVID thing. What have you been? Anything jump out on you that you've been doing lately? That's like this is really great, or you know.
I mixed somebody's album recently, but I can't tell you that I'm not allowed to say what it is. I've done just one. We did one in-person recording session since this whole thing's happened. I have another one coming up in a couple of weeks. I'm still pretty careful and nervous about that stuff. I think people are too quick to act like it's all over when it's clearly not.
Well, it's not.
Clearly not.
Clearly not. We got issues.
But I'm doing a lot of writing, and I'm doing some mixing and various projects from home. I mean, lucky that I can't bring a band in here, but I mean, I can mix and write and overdub and, you know, just do my end of things from my home studio, and it works well. So,
when was the last tour with Cyndi? How long ago was that?
I don't know. I guess in the autumn, last autumn.
Oh, so relatively recently.
They're busy.
Yeah. Well, what is that? Six, 8 months ago. I mean, the last show we played was a Broadway Cares benefit. It was a benefit for Alan Cumming's birthday, I think. And that was March 2nd. So it was just on the
edge. So it's basically like a week before all hell broke loose. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And then about a week later, there was another benefit in New York that a bunch of friends of mine played. And out of that, a bunch of the crew, a bunch of the band, right. probably members of the audience, many people were infected and got sick. And,
wow.
You know,
right. I remember reading about that.
News.
Okay. Yeah.
So we were just about a week ahead of where things could have been really bad just by luck. But,
you know, it's a shame. With Bill, we could have had like multiple podcasts because there's a whole topic that I loved your trans, because Bill, you know, disciplined, you weren't, a total analog dog, analog guy that transitioned to, and I don't know if it was like, you know, you just moved with the times, but learning about, you know, digital and using digital and now becoming the guy that like with Pro Tools or anything, you know, everybody comes to Bill to ask your advice. I mean, you know, on how to do it.
I don't know about that. There are a lot of people who are way more Pro Tools literate or expert than I am. I like to think I know what I'm doing in terms of recording and mixing as a practice. Tools is just the thing in the way.
Right.
You know?
Right,
It's like I get around in it well enough to get around in it, but I'm hardly an expert. But no, the answer to that is I was dragged kicking and screaming and was one of the last,
right.
I think, to make the transition. And I credit Eric was enormously helpful to me in that. He actually lent me a 001 and a computer to play around with it. Uh-huh. Go, take this home and play around with it for a week or whatever it was. And I had been hired to do a couple of records where they were doing it in Pro Tools or largely in Pro Tools, and I was just sort of sitting at the console, and then I'd have to turn and say, oh, how do I do this? Or, you know, have a Pro Tools guy there.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was that era where a lot of us had to have a Pro Tools operator in the room because we were not capable of doing it. And it just got silly. You know, it's like to have that extra layer, I sort of had to force myself to learn how to do it. And then it turns out that was inevitable because almost everyone now is at least somewhat, I don't think there's any such thing anymore as 100% analog recording engineer.
Yeah.
I mean, people do record analog. I still do a couple of 100% analog records a year usually, but there's no way to avoid working in the box now. I mean, pretty much everybody has to do it.
Yeah. It's, that's, we're in the digital world, that's for sure. That's, but I do miss those days because I hear those records and I go back to listen to the records that we did it. And I don't know, I feel like they're just a little different, you know? You hear the drums.
Well, they're not only, they're different for a couple of reasons. I mean, to me, if I make an entirely Pro Tools or digital record in a big studio with the whole band on the floor playing live and you know, all the rest of it is the way it was, it's very hard to tell the difference there. The difference is that we're not making records like that generally, and big studios are going away, and consoles are going away, and big monitor systems are going away. Yeah. You know, it's like as we end up doing things one thing at a time in bedrooms, and, you know, now we're not even doing it in one little studio. You're getting I'll email you the drums.
I know.
Ed will email you the
drums
and you'll.
Yeah.
That's the worst way to make a record, because again, this comes down to the issue of the producer. If you don't have the one guy or woman with a hand on the throttle, if it's just like, oh, I will trust somebody to send me guitars and hope they fit into my session.
Right.
That's the issue, and that's why those records sound different, I think, more than the analog digital difference.
Mm. Indeed.
William, is there somebody on your list that you've never worked with who you are dying to work with?
I don't know. I mean, I'm a, you know, huge Beatles fan, so I mean, you know, I've obviously McCartney would be pretty high on the list. I mean, I don't know how, it'd be pretty intimidating too. So I mean, I don't know how easy it is to tell Paul. You know,
that would be great, though. You know.
Well, speaking of that, happy
that Everest, I guess. Yeah.
Just speaking of that, happy birthday to Ringo Starr, 80 today.
Yeah, Ringo's 80.
Ringo's 80 today. So.
I know, and he doesn't look a day over 78.
Everybody was talking this morning. I was watching the morning news about how young he looked. You know, it's amazing what happens when you you stop that. He looks good. He looks great.
So yeah, yeah, Paul. Well, Dave's met Paul. You said he's very humble.
He was nice. He was nice, a nice guy. You've met him before, right?
I've met them all.
Yeah.
It's not that you can't have, and of all of them, you know, you're talking about McCartney is the most social, like knows what to say, knows how intimidated people are, has a way of putting you at ease.
Right.
But that's got to be, and being in the studio and having to say,
right.
No, I don't. Are you sure that song's good, Paul?
Yeah.
You know, you're probably not doing it.
Yeah. I love listening to his records. When I was giving one, my student right now, his chore is to learn Here Comes the Sun, which was Harrison, but it was the Beatles, of course, playing and listening that, you know, he'd really kind of fluffed through. And I said, listen to that middle section, what's happening there. And, you know, it's tricky.
Oh, that's a weird bit.
Yes, totally. Yes. Da-na-na. You know, you know it. Here we go.
All right.
It's some crazy stuff going on there, and it's not easy.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, but George explained it in Indian terms. It was ba da da ba da da ba da da ba da ba. So right. You know, and he has sort of Indian syllables that he would use. It was Indian music rhythm.
Right.
But even George Martin was confused.
It's like, what time is that?
By it. How do you explain it? You don't count your way through it.
Right.
You just learn it and then remember it.
Yeah, I told my student, listen to that melody and listen what's happening. But you know, it's a learning experience. So he's kind of like writing some things out and playing it. But it's musically, I said, you know, I'm sure they're in there and listening to that melody you just played, and it's brilliant stuff.
But then again, this 3-1-2-3-1-2-3-1-2-1.
Right.
It's a weird rhythm.
Indeed. Yeah. Yes. It's good stuff. You know. I mean, the Beatles were always doing something. The Beatles channel on Sirius is great. I love to listen to the stuff coming through there because they were all so great, and their songs were just so thought out, and the parts, and you know, they weren't mailing it in. You know, it was like some incredible productions.
No, especially well in the beginning, they kind of blasted their way through.
Yeah,
and just kind of brilliant. But later on, you know, they were the first ones to take forever to, you know, what was it, 8 days or 10 days to do I Want You.
Right,
you know, it's
right.
Like, no, fans were not spending a week doing one song, you know, and they the luxury of.
Well, hopefully you'll get to work with Paul. I mean, I think that would be an awesome record to hear that happen. It'd be great. So, because he's not retiring. It looks like he's still rocking away and doing, you know, as busy as ever. So, and so are you.
Right.
So hopefully this could happen, you know.
Yeah, why not? Sure.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we got to wrap it up. As you said, Dave, we had, you know, a whole lot of other stuff we could have gotten into with William.
So much.
I mean, it's the amount of work you've done through the years, great work, and the people you've worked with, it's all really cool stuff. And I've had a blast getting to meet you and hear the stories. And I know Dave's had a smile the whole time, as you
great.
Can see. So
it's great.
So, William, thank you so much for joining us. Anything that you've worked on recently that you want to give a quick promotion to or shout out that people should track down or?
No, I mean, find me if you like. It's weedywet.com if anybody wants to track me down.
Say it again, Bill. I think you broke up a little bit. Say that again, Bill.
Oh, weedywet. Weedywet.com. WEEDYWET.com.
All right, yeah, check it out, because when you see all the people that he's worked with, it's really cool stuff.
Amazing.
So thanks so much again for joining us, William, and continued
Bill,
success.
Thank you.
All right.
Great. It was wonderful. We had a great time.
Yeah, that was great, Dave. I do want to we'll mention our sponsors again real quick before we sign off. Gotpeace.com, Trudy Handelman. Check out the website. Buy some merchandise. A portion goes to good causes and helps promote peace and unity, which is great messages. And thanks again to Croker Percussion, CrokerPercussion.com. Please check out all kinds of really cool stuff from them. And the School of Rock in Berwyn, where Dave's a teacher. So if you sign up for lessons, Dave might give you a little remote teaching or social distance teaching, which is also very cool.
Here comes the sun.
Right. You can learn here comes the sun from
anyway,
Dave.
Anyway, everybody be safe out there. You know, we're living in trying times. So, you know, be kind to your neighbor and just do your best to wear your mask. And let's get through this stuff. And thanks, Taylor, for everything.
Right. Thanks to Taylor. Thanks to William Whitman. For Dave, I'm Andy. And we'll see you next time. One in the pocket.